Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor to welcome you to the teleclass, Leadership in Infection Prevention and Control. And this is a particular pleasure for me because I am able to introduce my very dear friend, Martin Kiernan. Martin is a nurse consultant in infection prevention at Southport and Ormskirk NHS Trust in the northwest of England. And he has worked in the field of infection prevention and control for almost a quarter of a century. Martin is a member of the Department of Health Advisory Committee on Antimicrobial Resistance and Healthcare-Associated Infection. He is a past president of the Infection Prevention Society, and he currently chairs the Healthcare Infection Society's Education Committee. Martin has two master's degrees in public health and in clinical research, and indeed he has published some really nice studies and papers. Martin has given lectures at infection control conferences on just about every continent in the world. And on top of all of that, as if that wasn't enough, Martin is one of the key people who put together a modest little lecture series called Teleclass Education. He is an incredibly bright guy, a very entertaining speaker, and a very good friend. So to give the teleclass Leadership in Infection Prevention and Control, I give you the one and absolute only Martin Kiernan. Martin.
Well, I don't really quite know what to say, Paul. Thank you very much for that. I think I wish my mother had been listening to that. I'm almost looking over my shoulder to wonder who you're talking about. But anyway, greetings to everybody listening in, and to those of you who are listening to this subsequently on the recordings. It's a great pleasure to present on this subject of leadership and infection prevention and control, because I firmly believe that if you're working in the field of infection control, you have to be a leader, because you're expecting people to follow your advice and what you're going to suggest. Moving on to slide two, which is the session outline, I want to firstly talk about the concept of leadership, and I'm going to be talking a bit about some of the main theories. I won't be going into those in enormous depth, because that would be a whole lecture series in itself. But I want to give people an understanding of the importance of leadership in infection prevention and control, and then I'll be outlining this with some examples. But I need to add a health warning in that leadership has been very poorly studied in social, and by that I mean non-profit making organisations. And now that may not apply to some organisations in the United States, but in the UK certainly we aren't supposedly non-profit making organisations. And very little work has been done on leadership in that sort of setting. Most of the leadership theory comes from the world of business. But there are lessons we can learn from that. Okay. Why do we need to be leadership? Well, if we go on to slide three, the delivery of medicine and the delivery of healthcare ought to be a highly reliable industry. We're dealing with people's lives. We use enormous amounts of resources. There's a lot of cost, there's a lot of human cost involved in the delivery of healthcare, especially where things go wrong. But the practice of medicine and settings in which healthcare are delivered are very complicated systems. And unfortunately, the weakest part in any system is going to cause you a big problem, and humans play a key role in these complex systems. The procedures we undertake are extremely technical. They're often extremely risky for people. And although the delivery of healthcare should be a high reliability industry, the literature shows us that it is full of error. It can be unsafe for people, and sometimes it's not very effective in what we do. So we could almost say we were going to mirror ourselves on the airline industry, and people are very keen on doing that at the moment with the use of checklists. But I would suggest that the people involved in the airline industry, their primary intention is to keep themselves safe. And if everybody else comes along with them on the flight and they're safe, that's okay. And that's not quite the same when we're delivering healthcare. You don't have that personal interest in the way you're carrying about your daily business. The other thing happens is that things happen on a daily basis. People get ill. Staff members get ill. Equipment breaks down. Nothing lasts forever, especially if your maintenance schedules are not quite all they should be. People forget to do things. You know, we're all human. No matter how diligent and how important the tasks we do, you know, we do tend to forget things. And if you read Atul Gawande's excellent book, The Checklist Manifesto, and look at all the things that maybe would have got missed if it hadn't been for implementing such as what seems to be a simple measure as a checklist, where you actually just check off all the things you know you should be doing, but actually things get missed because people tend to forget them. Not on purpose. You know, healthcare workers don't wake up in the morning and think, "Oh, great, let's go to work and see what I can damage today." We all turn up with the thought we're going to be doing good for people, but things can get missed, especially when there's a lot going on. And all of these things happening as part of a normal, complex healthcare system. So what we have to do, moving on to the next slide, is try and convince people that they need to do something. Because clinical staff and nursing staff almost always know what they ought to do. Okay, when you talk to people about what should you do before you put an intravenous cannula, everybody knows they should clean their hands, everybody knows they should clean the skin before they're inserting the cannula, good aseptic technique, but they don't always do it. So although people may think that they know what to do, they aren't actually convinced necessarily of the need to do something. Okay? And I think there's an element of salesmanship in this. It's our job to convince staff that they need to do what actually they want to do. You'll find this in the operating theatre as well. You know the patient at induction needs a prophylactic antibiotic, but it's making sure people absolutely know the reason why they need to give it at a particular time and not, for example, after the tourniquet has gone on, where maybe it's not going to be so useful. So moving on to slide 5, I think there is a big element of salesmanship in our role as infection prevention control people. And I come back to salesmanship mainly because before I started nursing 30 years ago, I spent a couple of years selling cars. And I went on some very good sales training courses for a company called Vauxhall Motors here in the UK. I did it really because I was my hobby at the time was motorsport. I was rallying, and this gave me a bit of cash and some time to do it. But there's no long-term career in car salesmanship, whereas there is in healthcare. So I took a big hit in the wallet, but I managed to grow a professional career out of this. But I think we are salesmen. By the way, that isn't a photograph of me when I was a car salesman. I wouldn't have got very far like that. I think there is a definite an element of the salesmanship that we need and we can incorporate into our practice as infection prevention and control practitioners. Give example, going on to slide 6. Really, the salesmanship is the art of convincing people that they need something that they may want. Okay, you have to turn something from a want into a need. You might want a new computer, but you're only going to buy it when you need to buy it. Now, this generally isn't too difficult for men. I often want a new Apple MacBook, and I can convince myself I need it when they upgrade the model every couple of years. I may want to hit the golf ball a little bit further on the golf course. Actually, I'm normally fairly convinced I really do need to do that. Maybe everybody drops into the same category as men who always need the latest gizmo, but there is an art to selling, and there is an element of mutual gain in selling. Now, if you're talking about a commodity, there is the element of mutual gain is commission for the person who's actually making the sale, and the person who's buying it gets the product that hopefully they actually did want in the first place. Unfortunately, some salesmen will sell you things you didn't actually want or need, and you've really got to be up against your mettle because the people can be very effective at selling something. Now, infection prevention and control, our mutual gain in selling what we're trying to get people to do is actually we're seeing a reduction in infection. We're seeing patients suffer less. We're seeing organizations spend less on treating healthcare associated infection. So our commission, if you like, is job satisfaction. For me, that's always been a big part of the job anyway. And selling is a skill, even if the product isn't that appealing. And I'm not talking about appealing to you as the salesman. I'm talking about appealing to the person who you're trying to get to buy into what you're doing. So you have to try and alter the perception of the product, which can be very difficult sometimes, and the evidence of what we're selling is worthwhile buying into. If you go looking at HCPCS guidance into urinary catheters, a lot of it doesn't reach good, you know, Category 1 evidence. There's a lot of expert opinion kicking around there, and that can sometimes not help when you're trying to convince people. So if we go on to slide 7, if you're trying to sell a car, selling this sort of thing isn't going to be that easy. But it is of value to somebody, but what you would have to do is dress it up and say, well, actually, if I could convince you that even though it doesn't look very good, it is going to get you from A to B, and it will get you to where you need to go for a modest cost, then you might buy into this. Okay, I probably doubt it, but I mean, you could even say this is an appreciated classic of the future, a Ford Cortina from about 1973. But I suspect not too many people would buy that one either. But I think you get what I'm getting at here. You have to focus on people's interests and not necessarily their positions. That's very important. Okay, you have to understand why they are saying what they are saying, and not focus on it's getting an understanding of if they're getting in the way of decisions, if they're trying to block what you're trying to implement. You have to get to what their real objection is. And I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on. Now, there have been a few papers I'm going to talk about, looking at the association between leadership and practice, and we'll move on to slide 8. This is a fairly recent paper from the American Journal of Infection Control by Sinkovitz, Cochran and colleagues, who did a cross-sectional survey of 16 medical centers looking at hospital leadership coming from the top down within the organization. Not necessarily, of course, that leaders actually have to be at the top of organizations, and I'll come back to that later on. But they found that hospital leadership was seen as leaders regularly visiting units to help improve the quality of care, talking to people, getting amongst the staff. And a very important bit for me here is this helping the staff to implement their own solutions to problems. Because I find that if you try and impose a solution on somebody with the problem you've given them, then it's not necessarily going to work very well. And I'm going to come back to that one later on. And effective hospital leaders will actually help to implement staff ideas. Because actually, I've always found that it's the people who actually deliver the service who actually have a very good idea about what needs to be done. And yet, so often I find they are not actively engaged by senior folk who are setting strategy, and the systems don't work as well as they could do because the people who have to implement the new system, A, don't believe that what's being suggested will work, or B, have got actually a much better idea of how it could work anyway. Problem is they had no voice. In this paper, they found that leadership was positively associated with hand hygiene, compliance, and people wearing their appropriate protective clothing. So there is an element there of high-profile leaders can really make practice a lot better. And they also found that if you have good staff engagement with leaders, this was significantly associated with knowledge relating to infection prevention control issues such as the spread of MRSA and people's knowledge of these issues. I'll move on to the next slide, slide number 9. This is a good paper from Griffiths and colleagues published in the Journal of Hospital Infection in 2009, which did a scoping review looking at the risks for infection prevention and control problems in the organization. And they found a number of issues that contributed to the likelihood of an increase in infection control issues. Certainly weak or negative clinical leadership at ward level or above ward level had a really bad impact on the potential infections. Yeah. And another issue is absence of clear lines of clinical management and responsibility. And this is where I've always had a little bit of problem with the statement that infection control is everybody's responsibility. And to give an example, I just want to give you a little tale of four people called everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. There was an important job to be done, and everybody was asked to do it. Everybody was sure somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that, because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody recognized that everybody didn't do it. And that's the problem I have sometimes with saying something is everybody's responsibility. Actually, that generally means it's nobody's responsibility. Nobody does it. And so I don't say that to the staff when I'm at induction now. I say it's your responsibility, and I point to everybody in the room individually. It's people who have to know what their actual own personal responsibility for this is. And you should have clear lines of clinical management and lines of accountability within an organization. Other risks for infection prevention control problems in organizations were excessive span of control amongst clinical leaders, and I'll come back to that a little bit later on. People not being sure exactly of their roles and responsibilities, the lack of clear policies, no active support for training. These are real issues for infection control at the moment because when times are hard, training is often one of the first things that tends to get cut back. And the absence of an effective interdisciplinary multidisciplinary infection control team that were perceived as exercising positive leadership award at unit level. I often find people have a different view of how they are themselves seen as to how they see themselves with regard to infection prevention and control. And if I go on, I know plenty of managers working who are not working for an infection control, but they think they are leading from the forefront when it comes to infection control. They're often senior nursing managers, and they really feel they're leading everybody from the front. Come on, everybody, let's get out there and get those bugs. If you actually speak to the staff underneath them, moving on to slide 11, the actual staff view of these leaders is actually that they are being seen in not the most positive of manner, in that they're being seen as highly controlling, almost totally punitive in the way they go about things, barking orders, very little reward, often no idea why people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, and this leads to a very negative view of the person who actually has quite a positive view of themselves. And I suppose that the same could be true of me. If I move on to this is how I like to perceive myself. Kindly Uncle Martin here to help and support staff in their clinical endeavours with advice and steering them and giving them good advice on what the latest clinical evidence is, and I'm here to support people. I suspect, though, judging by the faces when I walk onto the ward sometime, that people's view of me is much more like almost the Antichrist. Oh no, it's infection control coming to see what we're going to be doing. The red uniforms we wear are really quite useful. We've coined an expression now in my organisation that this is the WHO unofficial sixth moment for hand hygiene. When people see a red uniform, they automatically drift off to the nearest hand sanitizer or sink and start cleaning their hands. I'm just unfortunate that we can't be on the wards all the time. So moving on to slide 14, let's think about what leadership actually is. And various different definitions of leadership. But Chemers, in his book, The Integrated Theory of Leadership, suggested that it's a process of social influence in which one person can enlist the aid and support of others in the accomplishment of a common task. And a few things I want to draw out of that. One is it's a social influence rather than a military type of order type of structure. It's enlisting the aid and support of others. I think that's very important. And the last bit is the most important part, in that it has to be a common task. Because if you're not all sharing in the same goal, then you're not going to be achieving what is suggested. There are any number of theories on leadership which can center on people's traits, what the situational interactions are, if it's status. Is it the function of the role? Is it people's behavior? Is it their actual status or power within the organization? Is it to do with their vision or values? Is it to do with the amount of charisma they have? Or is it their intelligence? I would suggest it's a mixture of all of these things. I've known people who are extremely effective leaders and yet maybe do not have a large amount of intelligence. I've known people who are incredibly intelligent and have no charisma, yet are extremely effective leaders because of the respect they bring to the table, because people respect them for their clinical knowledge, their wisdom, and their pragmatism. I would suggest that it's often a mixture of these things, but I don't think you could bottle what leadership is. I mean, some, such as Galton a long time ago, argued that leaders are born, not created. I suspect there is an element of that, but I also suspect that if people work hard at leadership and are prepared to put the effort in, then they can actually start to create their own persona as leaders. Even if they aren't born with charisma, they may be able to develop the skills of being able to get people on side, which is really important. Moving on to slide 15, Burns looked at transactional leadership, which is the relationship between a group and its leader, where the leader is given power to perform tasks and they evaluate and correct and train people who work for that leader. And when productivity is not up to a desired standard, they will re-evaluate the tasks and correct them. And they reward effectiveness when you get to the expected outcome. So the transactional leader motivates the team to be effective and efficient. It's communication is the key part of this, because the leader is highly visible with an effective chain of command. But transactional leaders tend to focus on the big picture and don't really do the details. They may be looking for new ways towards achieving their vision, but they don't necessarily share that vision with the people working with them. Now, a lot of this works, I think, on emotions, and I want to focus on this just for a moment or two. If we move on to slide 16, and this paper from Psychote and Saavedra looked at the effect of emotions, and they found there were three ways in which a leader's mood affects a group of people who are working with that leader. Positive mood definitely affects the individual mood of those being led in a positive manner, and this is called emotional contagion, and that's how charismatic leaders will tend to work. And the leader's mood can actually affect not only the individual mood of those being led, but they can affect the collective mood of a group as well, and that can be affected by a positive mood of the leader. And expressions of positive moods by leaders do give a signal out that actually leaders are showing that progress towards the shared goals to be good. And people do respond positively, and they respond to these signals cognitively and behaviorally in ways that are reflected in group processes. So if the leader is giving out through his mood and his expressions and his emotions that he's showing that progress is good, then this has a positive effect on the mood of the group. And it's very, very important, I think, because the opposite is also very true. A negative mood spreads very quickly throughout a group of people. And this is true in sports. I'm sure in sports all over the world, if a team is doing very badly and is not being necessarily that well led, and we're going through this in the UK at the moment where it's the end of the soccer season and there's lots of teams that are close to losing their place in the division that they're in and are about to drop into lower divisions. And a few weeks ago there was an enormous turnover in managers of teams, and suddenly you find that the new manager has a positive effect on the mood of the players who haven't changed at all. The club still has the same group of players, but suddenly they're all performing because they have had a lift in mood, and they have new optimism, and they start to perform in a better manner. Moving on to slide 17. People have looked at behavioural and style theories. Leaders generally have a pretty strong personality and a very well-developed ego. They are generally self-confident and have a strong sense of self-esteem, and that is felt by McClellan to be vital. There are different types of styles, whether it's authoritarian, democratic, or laissez-faire, where leaders influence and exercise influence over group decision-making, feedback, praise and criticism, and management of group tasks. But this power of positive reinforcement that I've just been referring to with the mood was researched by Skinner, who actually did some studies that showed that positive reinforcement showed in an industrial environment a 17% increase in performance just by telling people that they're doing good. And I think sometimes in infection prevention and control, we're very good, and organizations are very good at telling people where things are not going well. Well, they don't tend to say when things are going well. Infection rates in the UK have come down quite dramatically in the last couple of years for organisms such as MRSA and C. diff. And yet when you talk to healthcare staff, many of them don't have any real idea of just how much they've come down. But, you know, we have to tell people they're doing a good job. I'm very fortunate in working for an organization that I think has an extremely effective chief executive officer. And if we have an issue with norovirus in this organization, we do not pay the cleaning staff any more money. We don't give them any bonuses, but they work extremely hard when there's a norovirus issue. And what tends to happen at the end of the outbreak is I'll go and have a little word in his ear and say, outbreak's over, would you mind going to have a word? He'll go straight out to the ward or department that have had the outbreak, and he'll find every member of the cleaning staff, and he'll thank them personally for their hard work. It probably takes him less than 10 to 15 minutes to do that. But the lift in mood of the staff, who are getting no extra money, but the lift in their mood and through this positive reinforcement and just saying a simple thing like thank you is worth more than any temporary bonus that will be forgotten immediately. I think that's a very important point. Moving on to slide 18, as opposed to transactional leaders, there are transformational leaders. And transformational leaders have their vision for the organization, but they, more importantly, they share their vision for what the organization can be. They invest a lot of effort in developing people and stimulating people to exceed their own self-interest for a higher purpose. That's really important, because in healthcare, often you'll find groups of staff work in silos. and they need to see and they need to feel part of working for an organizational goal rather than just their own narrow interest. That's very important. These leader-follower relationships with transformational leaders are based on exchanges and interactions and communication between the leader and the people who work for them. So they're active and they're engaged with their teams. And you can contrast this with management by exception, where the leader only says takes action when things become serious or when he absolutely has to, or if they're a laissez-faire type of leader where they actually avoid all forms of leadership responsibilities. Sometimes people are placed in leadership roles when they're not really fitted to take that sort of role, and they don't have the leadership responsibility, and they don't really want to take that on board, and that's disappointing when that happens. A good example of that is the Healthcare Commission in the UK, who produced some very good reports in the mid-2000s into infection control outbreaks, which provided powerful examples of leadership failures relating to infection control. Going on to slide 19, one of the highest profile outbreaks we had was outbreaks of Clostridium difficile infection at Stoke Mandeville hospitals in Buckinghamshire. And this was written up and can still be found on the internet in July 2006. 41 deaths directly attributable. Possibly there were another 24 deaths attributable to these outbreaks. And the important thing was that there were two outbreaks and the lessons were not learned, so because they were virtually two identical outbreaks. And I mean, anybody can have an outbreak, but when you have an outbreak, you learn the lessons and you don't have the second outbreak. And that was the problem at Stoke Mandeville. Moving on to slide 20, there was a really large failing at the highest levels of the organization to give priority to the second outbreak. And the managers didn't follow their advice of their own infection control team, nor of the Health Protection Agency, who are an external expert agency who would give advice to these organizations. The managers in this organization placed other targets like waiting lists and like getting people out of the A&E department within 4 hours before patient safety. So they had the priorities all wrong. Interestingly, the week before the report came out, the chief executive of the organization, the nurse director and the chairman of the organization all resigned, although the medical director got to stay. So you can see who has the better friends in high places. Now, what is good about this report is if you look at the actions of the infection control team, they were tenacious. They provided extremely good advice that was ignored. They were also very good at documenting their advice, and that was highlighted in the report. They performed in a tremendous manner that was inspirational to many of us. And the leader of that team, Rose Gallagher, is now a senior nurse for infection control for the Royal College of Nursing in England and is widely seen as one of the country's leading lights in infection prevention and control. The problem for this organization was that the managers in the organization just didn't realize that the infection control team were trying to protect the organization as well as the patients. The advice was not just given for patient safety, it was also given for organizational safety, but they really just didn't get it. And to give you another example, a number of years ago, now in 2006, the Department of Health set reduction targets for MRSA bloodstream infections. And at first, the infection rates really just didn't fall at all. And moving on to slide 22, the Department of Health then sent support teams into NHS organisations when the bloodstream infections didn't fall. Infection control teams didn't really like this because they felt they were being excluded from the process. And they felt, and they made to feel, it's fair to say, that they were personally responsible for the failures of organisations during this time. Because infection control at the time was very much seen as that's the job of the infection control team. There was no big organisational buy-in. Many teams were actually doing very well, but some were not because they had no voice in their organisation. Moving on to slide 23. I've been a member of teams going into organisations to provide advice, and I don't think I've virtually never told an organisation anything that their own infection control team didn't know and hadn't been telling them. But the problem is, you're never a prophet in your own land, as it were. You know, who is an expert in their own home? To give you a good example, I'm from an orthopaedic nursing background. I did it for many years. I'm orthopaedic trained. If one of my children sprains their ankle, I'm fairly confident it's a sprain. Does my wife acknowledge me as an expert in this field? Absolutely not. I still end up in the local minor injuries unit with the child with a sprain that I know it's a sprain, but of course, because she knows me, she doesn't actually believe that I'm an expert in this manner. And this is often a problem. It's very frustrating, I'm sure, for an infection control team to have an external person come in and tell the organisation. exactly what they'd been telling them for a while, but they had no voice, and that was a real problem. And the problem we found with these Department of Health teams were that the infection control teams had no voice within the organisation, were actually often buffered from senior management by layers. So they would report to a senior manager who would report to an assistant director, and I think it would report to the director of risk, who would then report to the director of infection prevention and control. So there were often three or four layers, which meant the dilution of the message was such that the message really, and the sense of the message never really reached the higher levels of the organisation. We looked at how infection control teams work, and that's on slide 24, and we had traditional infection control teams where the subject was very high in profile, and you know, people felt, oh yes, infection control is very important, but actually the team themselves had quite a low profile in the organisation and would just tend to make phone calls or occasionally visit wards, but not really be out and about supporting. They were seen to be very reactive. They were seen to keep control and do a lot of the infection control. They would write reports. They would write the organisation's infection prevention and control programme. They would write that for the organisation. And, of course, that meant there was no organisational ownership of the infection control programme. And sometimes teams did what I would think of the easy things and did not put things in the infection control programme if they thought they were likely to be unsuccessful. And that was a problem. And I've always firmly believed that an organisation's infection prevention and control programme should not be written by the infection control team alone. They should be advising the organisation, but the organisation should have a say in the priorities that it wants to achieve for infection control. Now, what we did find as a counterbalance to the more traditional infection control team, go on to slide 25, is that actually a more modern team is more prominent, very visible, very proactive, and their job is to actually provide expert input for others to do. I spent probably the first half of my time working in infection control, just called an infection control nurse. But the bottom line was, I controlled nothing. I see my job as to advise and support people who are actually going to do infection control, which is the people working in the clinical areas. So a more modern infection control team, and this is where we looked to the other side of the Atlantic, to the US, where they used and have always used data to try and drive improvement. And with a good infection control program that it belongs to everybody, then the organisation is really going to have much more buy-in. So with this prominent, highly visible, highly proactive team, I would strongly suggest that people working in those teams were exhibiting a form of leadership. Because I've always believed in one thing, moving on to slide 26, I think this is really important. This is a quotation from the mid-1600s. This is, "He who complies against his will is of his own opinion still." And I always feel personally that if you tell someone you've got an issue and you're just going to sort this out, it really isn't going to work. Okay. If you move on to slide 27, if you say to somebody, you've got a problem and you better fix it, the first thing is that the person does not own the problem. They may not even necessarily believe they have the problem. They maybe even go through the stages of grief, the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, you know, where they start off with denial. Well, I haven't got a problem. Well, the data's all wrong anyway. And so that's not really going to work. Much better, moving on the next slide, is actually, the organisation has a problem. How are you going to sort it out? Now, that is saying that's a bit more inclusive in the problem side of things, but it's still putting the whole onus of sorting it out on the person who maybe doesn't still recognise they have a problem. Even better, moving on to the next slide, is, well, we've got a problem, how do we fix it? So that means, okay, the organisation has a problem, how do we get together and do something, but that's still a little bit pushing the problem into somebody else. For me, a nirvana is making people think they have the problem themselves. That's by giving them the data and highlighting to them so that they actually come to the conclusion, actually, we've got a problem here, so that you get problem solving from the ground up, where people at the bottom line see the problem, they recognise they have a problem, start looking for solutions themselves, and then develop a fix for it, rather than being given a problem, you better sort it out. They don't believe that they have a problem necessarily. They don't put wholehearted effort into trying to fix it because they don't believe they have a problem, and really you're not going to get too far with that side of things. Now, a very good paper was published in 2010, moving on to slide 31. This is by Professor Sanjay Sain's group, published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, where they looked at the importance of leadership in preventing healthcare-associated infections. They did a mixed phase, three-phase projects study. They did a quantitative questionnaire, 14 organisations, and then further in-depth study of another six hospitals. and they found that leadership was an important, and it played a very important role in infection prevention activities, but most importantly, successful leaders do not have to be at the top of organizations. Now, in England, at the moment, we have a role of a director of infection prevention and control in every hospital organization, and it is somebody who has to report to board level. And some organizations have taken it that the person can only be a member of the board who is the director of infection prevention and control. Other organizations have said, no, they can be anywhere in the organization as long as they have access to the board. The important thing for me is that they actually have the leadership qualities and they have the commitment to undertake that role, and that is really very important. So this was a really good study. They gave very good examples throughout it, and they give some examples in organizations with a high management turnover where you would struggle to get the embedded leadership at the top of the organization because the managers are changing regularly. Well, in this good example, the chief of medicine and the epidemiologist and the lead infection control practitioner were absolutely crucial to getting leadership going and the focus on infection control. What they did was form partnerships with unit managers and not necessarily senior managers, and they put together this well-reasoned approach to the use of evidence-based practice, and they were quite discerning in which practices to implement. But when they did say, this is what we're going to do, and the quote is great, we take evidence-based medicine, we say, this is the way it is, and if you don't like it, go somewhere else. That's the end of the discussion. That's providing a very strong steer from the organization. This is what we're going to do. Moving on to the next slide. So successful leaders in infection control cultivated this culture of clinical excellence. And it's important to develop a vision for the organization and to articulate this organization culture extremely well. But then you have to convey that to staff at all levels. Everybody has to buy into it. Everybody has to understand that this is where the organization is going. This is what the organization's values are. So these leaders focused on overcoming barriers. And I'm going to come back to this a little bit later in the talk, because often I've found in infection control, you come up against barriers and blocks along the way, and you're really going to struggle sometimes to break down these barriers. And what they did was good leaders were very focused on overcoming the barriers and did not just throw out their hands and say, well, the system is such that I'm really not going to be able to make change here. So what they're trying to do is actually take the issue out of the area of the organizational disconnect by actually dealing directly with the staff who were resistant to change or resistant to implementing new processes or procedures that it would impede infection prevention and control. What good leaders do in infection control is they cultivate leadership skills, but they, more importantly, they inspire the people they supervise and they give advice and support to. And this inspiration was described by staff as being very motivating and energized them to work towards the goal of preventing healthcare-associated infection. And to me, you provide this with data and constant feedback. And if you're trying to implement something, tell people why they're implementing it for a start, and then give them good feedback as to why you want them to do it and what the impact of that has been. To be a good example, a couple of years ago, we had to implement routine emergency MRSA screening for all patients in the UK. But years before that, in my organisation, we decided to screen patients from long-term care facilities. And this meant extra work for staff in the accident emergency department. So what we did was go and talk to the A&E staff and say to them, this is why we want to do this, because we feel there's an extra colonisation in these areas, and we need to protect them at a vulnerable time when we go in. We gave them some education about this, and then we started the screening. And what we would then do is go back every week and say, look, these 20 people have been picked up as positive on the screens. Last week, if you hadn't done this, they would have been in our organization. There would have been an increased risk of cross-infection, and they could have actually infected themselves from what we did to them. So because of you doing this piece of work for you, which has no direct benefit for you, this is how the impact has been on the rest of the organization. And that really did motivate them to actually get very good compliance with their screening. Moving back to Sanjay Sank's paper, going on to slide 33 now, they gave also very good examples of non-inspirational leadership. Say, for example, where you're in the military model and you hear loads about productivity and meeting standards, but you don't hear much about innovation, and that is not a part of the culture. Or there's this huge disconnect between administrative policies and process and what actually inspires, motivates and awakens frontline people. If an organization is very top down, that is non-inspirational leadership. Going on to slide 34, Good, successful leaders think strategically, but they act locally. And this is really important if you're going to try and break down the barriers, I find. Now, sometimes you need to canvas before crucial committee meetings. And I certainly would do this. If I'm going to a meeting and I know there's going to be a contentious issue, I know who's on the committee. I know who is likely to provide a challenge at that meeting. And often it's a really good idea to maybe go and spend 10, 15 minutes with them before and just say, before the meeting, could I discuss a few of these points with you just to clear them up and get some of what your sense of it is? And often you can actually head off potential objections and problems well before you can get to the meeting. Successful leaders also, they'll use their personal prestige or their status within their organisation to try and move initiative forward, and they'll form partnerships across disciplines to try and get people to see outside of the silo, outside of the narrow self-interest of their own department. And in Sanjay Sank's paper, they found that epidemiologists and infection preventionists actually had far more important leadership roles in their hospital's patient safety activities than did senior executives. And I don't think any of us working in this field would find that a surprise at all. Going on to slide 35, this was a good example of an organisation that had really fostered this culture of clinical excellence. And everybody in the organisation, including the chief exec, was espousing the importance of patient-centred care. And I think this is a really great example where the chief executive's strategy for solving disagreements about resources and resource use in the organisation was straightforward, just say what is best for the patient. And that generally there's no argument about that one from anybody. Because who could argue, oh, we're going to implement a solution that is not best for the patient? Very important. The chief exec explained that this organisation, the chief exec says, we are the best public hospital. We're always on the map because of the excellent stuff that goes on here. That's a very good example of everybody knowing exactly what the organisation's culture and where they're coming from. Another good example I felt was using the limits of leadership, where a good leader can find their way around issues. And this was a chief nurse at one hospital who was struggling with rigid employment rules and had a lot of staff there who they just really couldn't seem to get rid of. And they created what they called employment opportunities, which I think is a really good way of putting it, in that they brought in more stringent policies. So those nurses who are actually taking advantage of the system in their organisation were more likely to voluntarily leave. And the good example was when this chief nurse came, nurses didn't take blood, they didn't put in IV cannulas, they didn't put catheters. So the chief nurse said, that stops, we're going to give you courses because you should be able to do this, you're registered nurses, and the people who like working there because they didn't have to do those actually left. They created what they called turnover opportunities. Really good expression. Going on to slide 37, Sanjay and colleagues, they drew a distinction between transactional leaders who guide followers by ensuring roles that are tasks are clearly specified and using reward and punishment and motivation, and transpirational leaders who are more inspiration in their way of going about things, and they inspire their followers to see beyond their perceived first interest. Definitely, I think, I agree with their points about this distinction between sort of transactional and transformational leadership, because the lines definitely between the two are blurred. They are complementary, and these authors suggested that transformational leadership builds on transactional leadership. I think always you need elements of both. So they found, moving on to slide 38, that nurses with leadership qualities did mainly three things. They dealt with overcoming barriers, they focused on those, they dealt directly with the resistant staff, and they processed issues that actually impeded the prevention of healthcare-associated infections. They knew the way around it. But leadership isn't easy, okay? And I'm going on to slide 39 now. And that you're going to meet, if you're going to try and get people on board and trying to force through issues that are being blocked, you're going to meet the following people on your journey. Firstly, you're going to meet the know-it-all, you're going to meet the sniper, you're going to meet the negativist, and you're going to meet the obstinate person. And I just want to give you a few tips as to how to deal with these people. You can be sitting at a meeting and the know-it-all will be there. They're always right, and they'll let you know it. They have great knowledge, they're very competent, they enjoy being challenged because it gives them an opportunity to show off. And I think you'll all recognise people who are like that at meetings. They'd like to be seen as a leader, and they're a very important person. What they'll tend to do is they'll find the issue that you're talking about, they'll nitpick over detail. They'll look for small, tiny arguments to try and show just how clever they are and how knowledgeable they are about the subject. The bad news for this is that you really have to do your homework. You have to know the subject in and out. Otherwise, they will use your lack of knowledge to try and unpick what you're trying to argue. It's really important that you do not try and undermine these people. You must listen very actively to them and let them know that you value their opinion and try and draw them out a little bit. Please say to them, well, this is a really good point, and maybe we need to take that into consideration. You must never correct these people in front of others, because otherwise they like a public argument, they like a public debate, and often the whole meeting will get derailed. Often, the good thing to do is to actually bring them further on board to be part of the decision-making process. Sometimes they'll be willing to do that, sometimes they won't be willing to do that, and they'll start to retreat, because all they wanted to do was show off how clever they were rather than actually be an active part. Either way, you either get them on board or they'll withdraw because they've made their point and they'll back out of it. But the most important thing, as I stressed earlier on, is if you're going to come across the know-it-all, you must do your homework. It's very, very important. Next person you could meet is the sniper. Now, this is the person that sits at the back making sarcastic little remarks to everybody, or they'll make an out loud sarcastic remark. Everybody can hear, just trying to get people to laugh. And this is generally done so that it raises their own self-esteem and makes them feel very important. Very important to bring them out of hiding. Don't ignore them, remark. Okay? Don't be amused by the comment. Try and take it seriously. Try and say to them, well, actually, I think you might have made a really good point there. The first thing that happens is they probably won't do it again. But then you say, well, okay, I take your point on board, and maybe we can get together where I can take your comments very seriously, and where we can meet so I can hear your grievances and I can hear what you're saying so we can move forward. Try and flush them out. It's very important. The next one is somebody you're going to meet a lot of is the negativist. They'll throw cold water on any idea. They'll tell you this won't work. They'll say, well, we tried that years ago. It didn't work. Or they'll find any possible reason why it won't work. They'll maybe appear quite angry. They'll be quite resentful, probably because they feel that they are not particularly in control over the action, and maybe they don't trust those who are in power. With these sort of people, you have to remain very optimistic. You must remain enthusiastic. You do not try and argue with them or try and make it into a winner or a loser situation where people, where there's a potential loss of face. If they're being generalized, well, that really won't work, we've tried that all before, try and funnel that down into specifics and say, well, exactly what didn't work before, because we need to understand that so that we can make it work this time. Very important. And then start to use them as the sounding board. And there's a temptation sometimes when people are being very negative, you to just say, well, they're very negative, and dismiss everything that they say. When in fact, people are sometimes very negative, are sometimes making what is an important point, but because of their manner and the way they go about it, it gets missed and gets dismissed. So it's very good to use these sort of people as a sounding board. If you know you have a negativist in a likely meeting, very good person to go and talk to beforehand. Okay? And if they are making advice when it's being based on facts, you have to show that you're listening to it. What you then do is, if they're part of a project, you must continually remind them of the successes. And if they've had a part in that success, you must highlight the fact that, we said we were going to do this. You very correctly said that might be an issue, and we put this in place, and that's worked now. That's very good. So you can draw them out from their negative behavior. Going on to slide 43, you then come across the obstinate person who resists change. They don't listen to anybody. They'll use stalling and delay, and when they're pushed, they just don't do it. Sometimes this can be because they actually don't understand what the changes are. Okay, and you mustn't assume that they do know what the changes are, so you must try and take time to explain to them, to these people, what's happening. Because sometimes the block is a bit of a smokescreen. You must never spring surprises on people like this. Give them a little bit of a time to get used to the idea. Okay, the stubbornness can be sometimes due to a feeling that they're being controlled. And many people, certainly at a senior level in healthcare, really don't like feeling they're being controlled. So you must allow them to get the feel they have options rather than being pushed into one corner, and ask for their opinions and for input, and that's how you deal with the obstinate person. Sometimes you have to sell the message, and what I suggest you do, moving on to slide 44, is consider the foot in the door, but watch for the camel's nose. Very important. Okay? Moving on to slide 45, the foot in the door is where you gain a small amount of success, and you then use that to leverage what you really want to do. And your children will do this to you all the time, and this is a really good example from mine. Can I just go over to Susan's house for an hour? Well, okay. And then you get the phone call 2 hours later, do you mind if I stay the night? And they've already got success, and they're going to build on that success to make sure that they get their desired outcome. Children are fantastically manipulative at doing this. Okay. The camel's nose, moving on to the next slide, is an Arabian proverb, which means if you allow one small thing to get in the way, in other words, once the camel gets his nose into the tent, his body will still follow. So if you allow in some small undesirable element, a bigger problem will invariably follow. And sometimes it's very easy when you're in a project situation to just say, well, okay, maybe we can just allow a bit of leeway in that area. But again, it's somebody using the toe in the door against you. So you have to be very careful about that. If people are throwing up big objections, moving on to slide 47, I always find it's really important to flush out what the problem is. Okay, to try and see if they'll give you an objection, you have to flush it out to say, well, to find out, is this the problem or is this a smokescreen? And this was actually something I learned selling cars. The technique is, if I could, would you, to flush out the real reason. And people say to me, well, yeah, I really would like to buy that, but it's green, you know, and I'm not buying a green car. So you say, well, okay, if I could get you a gold one, would you buy it? Oh, well, maybe not. And you can use that technique, you know. I don't believe there's any evidence to support what you're suggesting. They'll say to you, if you say, well, if I can give you good, robust studies that demonstrate that this is beneficial, would you then put this in place? And then they'll come back and say, well, yeah, but it might be more expensive. Well, if I could show you the studies that show you this is cost effective, would you then consider it? And then you get to the root of the problem, and then only then can you deal with it. That's really very, very important. Moving on to slide 48. Many of us have problems in organizations where you've got actually organizational barriers to empowerment, where you get positional authority. And that's very important for building our credibility and for introducing and sustaining new initiatives in infection prevention and control. And this is where you need support from your superiors. Moving on to the next slide, because definitely, absolutely critically, is that lukewarm support is better than no support. Okay? It's worse than no support. If people are half-hearted about support, then they will very quickly work out, actually, that manager's not that engaged in that, therefore I'm not going to have to do it. He's almost better saying nothing than saying, oh yeah, I'd sort of support that initiative. You know, if you really want to get good support going and get everybody engaged, everybody has to sign up to the program. Everybody has to know that they have. You know, there has to be, right from the top, throughout the organization, we are all signed up to this program, and everybody must understand this. Yeah, there's an old saying, again, from my car sales days, there is nothing as contagious as enthusiasm other than the lack of it. Okay. So if you're enthusiastic, that spreads. But if you're not enthusiastic, that goes a lot further. And the whole organization will know when somebody isn't enthusiastic about something, in which case you have no chance of implementing this. And this was a good precursor, really, to talking about the modern matron role in the UK, which was introduced a few years, where they did a survey of this. They brought back matrons, which is a historical role in Britain anyway. They brought that back, the role of the modern matron. There's a bit of political pressure on that. And the problem was they were given the title, but not really given the authority, and they weren't given the status in the organisation. And this survey of modern matrons found that there was lots of role conflicts and tensions. There was not much clarity and no shared understandings about the role. The matrons themselves had a very fragile sense of their authority in the organisation. There was a large blurred interface with other organization roles. They had a lot of competing priorities within the organization, so that nobody really quite knew what their priority was at any one time. Anyway, there was a big role overload where managing the hospital on a day-to-day basis was competing with the staff management and quality and safety issues, and there were lots of issues with grading and responsibilities. Moving on to the next slide. Sometimes the problem is that the effects of positive leadership are diffused by directly supervising large numbers of staff, and that's called your span of control. Whereas if you can clearly allocate direct supervision to appropriate managerial levels, that's very important, and that's your span of influence. Moving on to slide 52. So under a span of control system, you hold people accountable for what they can control. And you do get at an individual level some competition that fosters competition, where span of influence is much better at getting the whole organisation to come together in a more shared goal, where you actually hold people to accountable for what they can influence, which when you then measure at a team level fosters people to collaborate together for the good of the team and for the good of the organisation. So that's very important. So gaining commitment is very important. Okay, slide 53. The first step is get the leader to commit to doing whatever it is you want them to implement to improve patient safety. Pick the right people to use as a target. And that, another little bit of Carl Sales training, this is probably about the third or fourth time I've said this tonight, but you have to speak to the person who will say yes. You have to get the right people on board. And to give you a good example of that, there was a study done a number of years ago on the use of key opinion leaders in infection control. And this is Professor Sato, the microbiologist and Hong Kong's brother, who's a psychologist, produced this paper, slide 54 this is. And it's a number of years ago, but it's still a very important lesson to be learned, in that these opinion leaders within any group, and they use opinion leaders at departmental and ward level, they were members of the group who had a significant social influence over the others in the group, and they did not necessarily have to be the senior nurses in the group. They were often people with who other people would look to and would recognize as a leader. And this study found that new information must be accepted by these key crucial opinion leaders before it could be transmitted to the rest of the group. Otherwise, it was going to fail. These opinion leaders were identified by their peers by using quite a simple scoring method, like who do you listen to? They then involved these opinion leaders in the development of these interventions and in undertaking the education, and the new information was much better received. So there are ways of targeting people in the organization who can actually help you with your intervention. Moving on to slide 55, we're getting towards the last couple now, you'll be delighted to hear. There's an ex-NHS manager in the UK called Roy Lilly, and this is his website, www.nhsmanagers.net. And he shares lots of really good leadership-type quotes. And he has his laws of leadership. And I asked Roy if he'd mind me putting these on the slides, and he was quite happy to. So I'll give them to you because I think they're very good, and I'll just run through them. Leadership is about creating space to allow people to do the best job they could possibly can. You must not restrict people, you know. Roy talks about creating opportunities for people just to realize, A, how good they can be, but giving them the time to actually come to work and then and to actually really enjoy what they're doing. That's really important. Roy reckons that, or feels that great leaders listen, and they do listening better than anything else. They listen to people, focus their listening, they hunt down people to listen to, they get right into the organization to understand how it works, they listen to what people say, and then pay attention to everybody. Next one is very good point as well. What I mentioned earlier on about moods, leaders don't have bad days, especially on a bad day. Okay, if you are seen as a leader, perceived as a leader in the organization, even if you're fed up, even if you're low in mood, you have to bring a great attitude to work, because every hour while you're at work creates leadership opportunities for you while you're in your day-to-day job. Moving on to the next slide, leaders know they're not the whole show. They search out the people who actually are not happy, and the people who are down and are disappointed, and find out why, because it's those people will drag the organization down. Those people will stop you implementing the interventions that you want to. If things aren't going well, leaders say things are not going well. If it's wrong, they say it's wrong, but then they'll try and fix it. That's very important. They don't try and cover over issues when the organization has them. Often, I suppose, people might say infection control people generally do far too much of that. I don't know. Leaders know informed people don't fear change, and that's why they tell everybody what's happening. That's really important. Okay? If you want to implement a change, you tell people exactly why you're implementing the change, and not just, that's the change, you're going to do it. They must know why. It's going back to, he who complies against his will of his own opinion be still. Okay? And they're generous to what they know. Leaders hire people better than they are and let them get on with the job. I really do agree with it, allowing people creative freedom. Leaders say thank you with handwritten notes and everybody else, and I've used my own chief executive as an example of that one. And leaders also know that they don't know everything, and they will acknowledge if they don't know everything, and then they'll find someone who does know. There's no shame in saying, I don't know what that is. And Roy's bottom line is, and he always says this, is leaders are visible, have a vision, and they share it often. Moving on to slide 57, in concluding, I've always felt infection prevention is one of the areas in which a relatively small team within any size of organization can really be leaders and demonstrate practice that really positively affects both patient safety and the organization's use of very scarce and expensive resources, and can protect and enhance an organization's reputation. I've always believed that this is one of the few jobs in any healthcare organization where a small group can make an enormous difference. to virtually everybody around them. Even if nobody else recognizes it, you yourself will know what a difference you make. But it is not easy doing this job. You have to be tenacious. You have to have a clear vision. You must communicate this vision to everybody who's going to deliver it, because you're not going to. You've got to provide positive reinforcement, and you've got to stay in a good mood all the time. And that really isn't easy. I'll leave you with my last slide, which is the most important point of the lot. You may think you're a leader, and I know plenty of people who are leaders, but the bottom line is, if you have no followers, then you're not a leader. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much. You are certainly a leader. I know people who would follow you anywhere, and these points are very practical. There's good theory behind them, but you gave us some really important practical things. And I love that you used the CITO study at the end, where they looked for the de facto leaders in the various social groups around the organization and recruited them. I think that process evolved into what we now call positive deviance.
Absolutely, I would. Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. You know, that was the founding father of it, but it still stands, it's so true today, and it's 24 years on now, 23 years on.
I know of one facility that tried that and failed miserably because they saw the influence leaders were all the people who were the most negative, and they tried to recruit them and get them to become positive, and that just didn't work very well. You are giving another teleclass lecture this year. Martin's next lecture will be broadcast live from the Infection Prevention Society conference in October. And forgive me for not having that title right in front of me, Martin.
The title of that going to be talking about I'm going to be talking about the life and times of the urinary catheter.
That's right. Good. Well, that'll be.
I wanted to call it Lethal Weapon, but they wouldn't let me.
Thank you very much. I would like to acknowledge our patron sponsors, the World Health Organization, Clean Care, Safer Care, and Virox Technologies. These folk are good to us, and I thank them both. And Martin, thank you very much again. This is, as always, very entertaining, and it gives you a lot to think about. I hope to see you again soon, and to all of you who are joining us, I thank you for joining us today, and we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.